listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
As the list of names of dead and wounded at the borders of Gaza continued to climb over the week, the UN Security Council also took note of the continuing fighting in Syria. This was Stefan de Mistura, the UN Special Envoy on Syria, reporting to the Security Council on Wednesday in New York. His report was challenged by a number of others, including Syria's Deputy Permanent Representative. First, Special Envoy de Mistura.
Madam Ambassador, Madam President, thank you very much. When I last briefed the Security Council on the 9th of April, it was an emergency meeting. And on that occasion, I warned of the dangers to regional and international peace and security arising from developments in or related to Syria. Today, it's not an emergency meeting, I know. But the circumstances of an emergency very much remain. Tensions, I don't need to remind you, are high, and regional and international confrontations have occurred several times. Let me just highlight some recent events since the 9th of April. On the 13th of April, the United States, France, and the United Kingdom conducted missile strikes in response to the allegations of chemical weapons used in Eastern Ghouta. Those countries say that the strikes targeted three chemical research and production facilities near Damascus and Homs. On the 29th of April, strikes were reported on Syrian government military facilities in Hama and Aleppo. Some media outlets attributed these strikes to Israel, alleging that those killed included Iranian personnel as well. neither Israel nor Iran responded to those claims. On the 8th of May, strikes were reported just south of Damascus. Syrian state media attributed the strikes to Israel. Israel did not confirm this claim. Israel then said that he had detected, quote-unquote, irregular Iranian activity, unquote, in the occupied Golan, which it put under high alert. Between 9 and 10 May, Israel carried out dozens of strikes against presumed Iranian and Syrian government military targets across southern Syria. Israel authorities claim they were responding to Iranian forces firing rockets from Syrian territory at Israeli military targets in the occupied Syrian Golan. Iran condemned Israeli strikes and denied these claims. We are not in a position to independently verify every aspect of these incidents, but frankly, even an incomplete picture demonstrates a troubling trajectory of a ever more frequent and ever more intense international confrontations over Syria, unprecedented since 1973. The Secretary General has followed these developments, you know it, with great concern and has called for restraint for all parties to avoid any acts that could escalate the situation and worsen the suffering of the Syrian people. The Secretary General stressed that the UN has, quote, a duty to remind all parties of the obligation, particularly when dealing with matters of peace and security, to act consistently with the Charter of the UN and with international law in general, unquote. And on the issue of chemical weapons, let me again echo the Secretary General's call for this Council to, quote, agree on a dedicated mechanism for effective accountability for the use of chemical weapons in Syria, unquote. As of now, as you know very well, we are awaiting the results of the ongoing investigation by the OPCW fact-finding mission following their visit to Douma with a report to be issued to state parties to the Chemical Weapons Convention. But we have also seen concerning developments elsewhere in Syria. Evacuations from eastern Ghouta were similarly repeated in eastern Khalamun area, southern Damascus, and northern rural Homs. First, military escalation, incoming strikes, airstrikes and artillery, and outgoing towards Damascus mortars and rockets. Then, that was the pattern, then a negotiation followed by an agreement for the evacuation of those civilians and fighters unwilling to remain under Syrian government control or Russian Federation protection guarantees. We have also seen similar evacuations agreements being discussed in the province of Idlib, but in a completely different format, the reverse format. This time, we are talking about civilians and fighters in government control areas, basically Kefraya and Fua, now considering evacuating, starting with some medical evacuation, after 3 years of siege and intermittent attacks from the armed groups surrounding in that area. Let me share with you also a recurrent concern that I know all of you have. If civilians and fighters are simply just funneled into northern Syria, mostly Idlib, then this might only prove to be a postponement of a further conflict affecting many more people, and I would refer to it later on. Hence the importance of keeping a very close eye on future developments in the Idlib province. Meanwhile, civilians have continued to pay a terrible price. We are talking about 100,000, for instance, 110,000, actually, to be precise, people who have been evacuated to northwestern Syria and Euphrates Shield areas in the past 2 months. Many are reportedly traumatized and in urgent need of assistance and protection. Humanitarian partners are overwhelmed and stretched quite thin by the scale of this evacuation, but continue to do their utmost to respond to the growing needs with your assistance. If we see a junta scenario in Idlib, and here comes the point again of Idlib, this could be six times, I repeat, six times worse, affecting 2.3 million people there, of which half of them are already IDPs and who will have nowhere else to go because there is no other place to go once they are up there. But this is not purely a question of Syrian suffering. We fear that any escalation or substantial escalation in Idlib or in Dara and or in the northeast may also incur risks not only to Syrian civilians but also to international peace and security. Because, as you know, many of these areas contain external and international forces. Conflict there might entail confrontation with those forces, leading us down to a slippery slope towards regional or potential international conflict. Therefore, international discussions on how to prevent this, on the escalation in particular, are needed and are taking place, but need to be very intense. I was therefore encouraged, I just returned this morning from there, to see concrete discussions on the escalation when I attended the 9th high-level Astana meeting yesterday, particularly on the issue which I refer to, Idlib. Because on that one in particular, the three guarantors do have a say and have a capacity of avoiding it. This round in Astana did see constructive discussions on how this might be achieved, while fully keeping upfront Syria's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity. They did engage very actively in front of our own eyes on how to avoid worst-case scenario in Idlib. Also, in Astana, there was the second meeting of the working group on the release of detainees, abductees, the handover of bodies, and the identification of missing people, of which the UN is a member and a very proactive supporter, because that's what many hundreds of thousands of people in Syria are requesting and asking us to do. The working group members held constructive discussions on practical and concrete steps to address this key humanitarian issue. The guarantors informed us that they have secured the support, and that, if confirmed, is good news, of the parties for the activities taking place under the umbrella of the working group, which is a positive development. I hope we'll witness some progress, because so far these are preliminary discussions, we need progress, on this complex issue at the next meeting of the working group, which we heard is going to take place in Ankara. Madam President, the escalation is indispensable. That's what the Syrians themselves are telling us. But it is only one of the ingredients necessary to move on the political process. What we also need is to overcome concrete challenges to a meaningful Geneva process to implement Resolution 2254. As instructed by the Secretary General, I've been consulting with a broad spectrum of relevant stakeholders and proactively identified options for a meaningful relaunch of the UN-facilitated Geneva process. Over 2 weeks, I conducted an exhaustive tour of consultations with the Arab League, members of the Arab League, with Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, the EU High Representative, several key European countries, Turkey, the Russian Federation, the Islamic Republic of Iran, with members of this very council, all of you, including this very, in my opinion, productive and useful retreat in Sweden, and with the United States authorities when I came specifically to meet them in Washington a few days ago. And also with the Syrian government and the opposition, which I've been at the meeting because on the sidelines, but very useful sidelines, where they were in Astana yesterday and the day before yesterday. My deputy, Mr. Ramsey, was also in the region this past weekend for continued political contacts with the regional players. And my chief of political affairs, Robert Dunn, has also, while we are talking, traveled to China for exchanges of views with officials of this important member of the Security Council. What did I learn from this long tour? Well, I returned to Geneva with a mixed picture. You will not be surprised. Clearly, there are significant differences still. But, there is also much common ground and common interest on one, the need to de-escalate. On two, to form a constitutional committee under the UN auspices. Three, to facilitate the establishment of a safe, calm and neutral environment, which is then leading to all what we aim at in the political process. Four, to respect Syria's sovereignty, territorial integrity, independence. These commonalities, however, risk getting lost, especially in the absence of serious international dialogue, and I will refer to this. During my tour, this was my message to everyone: robust, strong, proactive, urgent, international dialogue and consensus is now needed more than ever. To create the minimum conditions, for a realistic, credible political process. We know much water has gone under the bridges, much has happened since the 2254 was adopted, so we are getting more and more realistic, but we need a credible political process which takes into account the current situation and does not forget 2254. We are not sitting idle as a secretariat in this regard. We are assessing a number of creative options to update, revive, and advance the Geneva-based political process. And let me put on record that the UN remains mobilized and ready to work on the formation of a constitutional committee according to the Sochi final declaration anytime. I therefore welcome the intention of the Astana guarantors to actively and regularly engage with the UN in Geneva so as to see a concrete follow-up to this declaration 3 months and a half after its adoption. I was also pleased to see a significant number of member states reaffirm the primacy of the UN-led Geneva process in general and the need for a constitutional committee working under UN auspices while I was in Brussels at the EU-UN Brussels conference on 24-25 April. The conference was clearly almost unanimously reiterating the message that the only solution to this crisis will be political, and only this political solution will pave the way for reconstruction efforts. In Brussels, we also saw the entire UN system highlighting the growing needs of millions of Syrians, including IDPs and neighboring countries hosting refugees. Let me also note the important contribution of the Syrian civil society in Brussels. In particular, during a side event organized by the EU and my own office, those present did not shy away from debating with each other, constructively and intensely, on complex issues such as transitional justice and sanctions. They all demanded the release of detainees, abductees and missing people. They all affirmed that any political solution must protect the right of refugees and IDPs. And despite their differences, Syrian civil society. They displayed a genuine commitment to dialogue and spirit of negotiation, what I hope can be replicated in the formal negotiations. In Brussels, I also met with a group of Syrian women activists who stressed that not enough has been done to secure the direct participation of Syrian women in the political process. I committed to translating our collective commitment to this inclusion into concrete measures and will count on your support to keep the promise. For instance, when in future intra-Syrian talks, I will be insisting that a relevant number of seats will be reserved exclusively for Syrian women. When I will be criticized, I hope you will be supporting me, because I know it won't be popular, but needs to be done. Finally, Madam President, let me briefly touch on an issue that was raised by the civil society in Brussels and by many Syrians elsewhere who have been writing to us. That is the possible implication of the newly adopted law number 10. We are quite aware of the concerns surrounding this law, and we and other UN partners are seeking clarifications on the law's goals and repercussions, especially for refugees and IDPs who do not have access to legal documentation. Madam President, let me conclude with two bottom lines. First, the escalation is critical between both the Syrian and international stakeholders, both regional and global. We hope that the relevant players can reestablish some overarching rules of the road in this regard. We stand ready to facilitate such aid discussions with focused support from the Council and key countries for the good offices of the Secretary General and myself. Second, we must revive the political process in terms of constitutional committee, but also in terms of some initial steps towards establishing safe, calm and neutral environment. We are ready to facilitate discussions on both. And let me stress that a critical component of either aspect of the political process is active, continuous and positive United Nations engagement with the Syrian parties. I repeat once again, we stand ready, and I'm saying it today, as ever, to engage with the Syrian government in Damascus. We will also continue our contact with the opposition and the Syrian civil society. To unlock these two aspects, careful diplomacy is more than ever required. Careful but proactive diplomacy, including at a high level. Hence, we look with interest at the forthcoming visits to Moscow and meetings of Chancellor Merkel and of President Macron later on with President Putin, which undoubtedly will not be avoiding the issue of a political process in Syria. The United Nations believes that there is an urgent need for high-level diplomacy. One, to support escalation and avoid any miscalculation and ensure a genuine communication system about a sustainable end to the conflict. With the support of the Secretary General, we shall increase our own efforts to contribute to this endeavor, including by offering further ideas and, if required, and we hope it will be required, bridging proposals. I will stop there. Thank you.
Syria's Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Mounzer Mounzer, took issue with some of the Mistura's claims and made the following comments through an interpreter.
Thank you, Madam President. Madam President, at the beginning, the delegations of the US, the UK, have sought to market falsified statements to justify their aggression against sovereign states, particularly against my country, Syria, so as to hide their direct involvement in terrorism sponsoring and the responsibility vis-a-vis the bloodletting in Syria. And I tell them that all the testimonies of thousands of Syrian citizens that have escaped the blockade of the armed terrorist groups in eastern Ghouta, they have testified in the media. All these testimonies prove that you are involved in the suffering of those citizens because you support those terrorist groups. You have proven through your positions, your actions, your malicious actions, and through your occupation, illegal occupation of a number of Syrian territories, you have proven that you cannot let go of your history of greed and occupation and imperialism. In this council, you claim falsely that you seek a political solution for the situation in Syria. And briefly, I tell you, we were able to defeat your agenda in Aleppo, Eastern Ghouta. Likewise, we will defeat you, and you will not be victorious in any area of my country. Madam President, the US, Britain, and France tirelessly worked since the beginning of the terrorist war against Syria. They have tirelessly supported and run this war for 7 years. They have also exploited the UN to be a political tool of pressure against the government of Syria, so that they would implement their hegemonous agenda and they would be able to interfere in our domestic affairs and destabilize my country. They have not used the UN to fight terrorism. This should have been the goal, to fight terrorism and its sponsors and to help the Syrians overcome their suffering due to the practices of the armed terrorist groups. The special envoy dedicated part of his statement to speak of the humanitarian situation. Here, I would like to reiterate that the Syrian government gives primacy to providing all forms of humanitarian assistance to all the affected Syrians, wherever they are in Syria. This is a duty, and we fulfill this duty. Madam President, the legal and constitutional obligation set forth by international points of reference and your resolutions towards combating terrorism has made it incumbent upon my government to undertake military operations in Eastern Ghouta to rescue the civilians from the grip of the armed terrorist groups that did hold them hostage and use them for years as human shields. And here I would like to affirm that, contrary to false narratives, the successful military operations of the Syrian Arab Army and its allies against the armed terrorist groups that did control a number of areas that are classified by the UN as besieged areas and hard-to-reach areas, in addition to the settlement and reconciliation agreements, all have reduced the suffering of civilians and reduced the number of such areas. And it facilitated the humanitarian access, including to Eastern Ghouta. Madam President, we deplore that the U.S. speaks of its keenness to reach a political agreement. Meanwhile, they have committed an aggression based on lies against my country simply because they seek to give support to the armed groups as they have been suffering losses in Eastern Ghouta. The U.S. was the country that supported the Israeli aggression on the 9th of May that came after Israel was not able to provide protection to their own proxy terrorist groups, and they were not able to implement the conspiracy against my country, its unity, territorial integrity, and sovereignty. Israel continues its dangerous aggression, and this would not have been possible without the continued unlimited support by the U.S. government, as it enjoys impunity thanks to the support in the council. This enables Israel to continue its terrorism and threaten international peace and security in the region and the world. The Syrian Arab Republic reaffirms that it is able and ready through its military and armed forces to fend off all aggressions against our sovereignty and independence. However, we would like to reiterate that any attempts to support the failing terrorism would not work. These flagrant violations would not be an obstacle in the way of our fight against terrorism across the Syrian territory. Madam President, yesterday we concluded round 9 of the Astana meeting. We are satisfied with the results of this round. We thank the delegations of Russia, Iran, and the host country, Kazakhstan, for making Astana a success with a view to combating terrorism. And the outcome document of the meeting did stress the unity, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of the Syrian Arab Republic against any external entities that violate this. The accomplishments of the Syrian army in cooperation with our friends and allies to liberate eastern Ghouta and the southern area of Damascus has made the capital, Damascus, and its surrounding areas and outskirts safe. We have also expelled the terrorists from the northern ruler areas of Homs, and this was the result of our accomplishments in cooperation with friends and brothers. Here we reaffirm that we continue to fight terrorism and liberate every single area of our territory from terrorism or from countries that are committing aggression against our sovereignty. In conclusion, the government of the Syrian Arab Republic will spare no effort to support all genuine efforts to arrive at a political solution through which Syrians and only Syrians will decide on their future and choices towards safeguarding Syria's sovereignty, independence, unity, and territorial integrity. I thank you, Madam President.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The transatlantic alliance system has weathered a number of storms during its 70-year history. We are told this is because of sustained American leadership. But can this same alliance system survive the storm named Trump? Crosstalking the transatlantic alliance system, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Babich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And we have Alex Christoforo. He is the director and writer for TheDuran.com. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Mark, let me go to you first here. I'm the oldest on the program right here, and I have a good memory of the transatlantic alliance system that's had its ups and downs. But this is turning into a sustained one. We're looking at security. We're looking at international agreements. Iran comes into play. We're looking at energy. And we're looking at, and Dima and I will talk about Italy a little bit later in the program. There is a swell, a grassroots swell of populism coming up in Europe. So, I mean,
protest.
There seems to be a cascade effect. There's a lot of elements in play right now, and I'm taking it seriously.
Yeah, I mean, this is a serious incident, and certainly from if you went simply by the headlines in the press on both sides of the Atlantic talking about the doom of the West and the breaking up of the transatlantic alliance, Deutsche Welle saying, can the transatlantic alliance survive Trump? But Unfortunately, we have all been here before. During the 8 long Bush years, books were being written comparing the U.S. to Mars and the EU to Venus and talking about their differences. And we had similar breakups with Reagan,
But there was a coalition, quote unquote, of the willing when it came to the invasion of Iraq. I mean, they did pull it off.
But the point is, will France and Germany pull it off this time? Germany said no at the time and actually sided with Putin. And we remember
We're going to go to the Russian angle on this here. Go ahead, Dima Jempel.
Well, it was Venus who first bombed Libya, for example. It was the French president who decided to bomb. You know, he had some very reliable information.
Sarkozy.
President Sarkozy. He had that reliable information from Bernard-Henri Lévy that, ultra-radical so-called philosopher who just went to Libya, talked to a few insurgents, and said that we need to save these Libyan Massouds, he said, referring to the Afghan warlord Ahmad Shah Massoud, who fought the Soviet troops in 1980s. So basically, I think that the amount of talk about a rift in the transatlantic alliance, you know, there is not such a big disagreement over Iran, but like any totalitarian structure, they are in panic about a small disagreement.
I think there is. I mean, let me go to Alex here because, I mean, the threat of sanctions against European companies here. I mean, not only is there a looming trade war, and we can talk about the specifics of that, but now, you know, basically going out and threatening the European companies there, and the Europeans have reacted with a blocking measure. I mean, this is different, gentlemen. This is very different than we've had in the past. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, this is very different because I think we're seeing the neoliberal honeymoon is definitely over. And that was 8 years with Obama, where you had Obama and Cameron and Merkel and all these people with this new rat pack of buddies that were, you know, running the world, you know, doing whatever they wanted to do. And you're seeing that come to a very decisive end with Trump. And Trump is very much, like it or not, Trump is keeping many of his campaign promises, especially in the foreign policy area, and most notably moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem and, of course, pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal. So I think that you're starting to see Europe react to what is essentially the neoliberal community and the neoliberal policy come to an end, and that's due to the Trump effect.
You know, Alex, is staying with you. I agree. He's keeping his campaign promises, and he doesn't care about the consequences. Mark, talk about that, because you said when we're going back to the Iraq war there, where France and Germany were hesitant, agreed with the Russians. Now we see agreement with Russia even more so. Is this a diplomatic opening for Russia?
Because
Merkel has gone to Sochi twice recently.
Just like during the Bush years, Russia will, of course, take any opportunity to find room between Europe and the United States. That has always been its policy. It understands that its room for maneuver is, you know, that it can make this crack widen is extremely limited.
Well, we have the Iran deal, and we have energy here, which is very important to the Germans and Europe in general.
This is the biggest news in the last week, is that Trump is waging an economic trade war on the world at this point. They're launching a war of tariffs against China. They've launched tariffs on steel and other things against South Korea, their ally in the Pacific. They've dropped out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, something that I actually agree with. But they've put new sanctions after sanctions on Russia. They've renewed sanctions on Iran and promised to go further, North Korea, Syria. Now they're threatening sanctions in two ways against Europe. And the first way is over the Iran deal, right, which the EU is bringing up a 1996 blocking statute to vainly try to combat. And the other way is they're attempting to now dictate the EU's energy policy and energy security, saying if Germany completes the Nord Stream 2 pipeline with Russia, that it will
possibly enact sanctions, okay. The same sanctions against Russia, against EU companies.
Let's remind our audience here the rationale, because Trump wants them to buy, the Europeans to buy American energy.
It's mafia.
I mean,
it's
America first. It does make a little bit of sense.
He makes them an offer they cannot refuse, basically.
They can't refuse,
but,
right.
But look, I think it's another case of chicken coming home to roost. At this program, we discussed several times that this campaign against Trump after his election, and even before his election, it reminded us of the campaigns against the vilified dictators, so-called dictators in Ukraine, in Syria, in Iraq. Then it was used against Trump, against the American president. In the same way, the war of sanctions, which the United States has been waging against Russia, against other countries, now it is turning against Europe, Something that the EU never expected to happen. Yes, they thought it would be used against other people. Now it's used against them. So that's a very interesting moment.
Alex, Dima brings up a really good point, because what has happened here is that the European Union has essentially left itself defenseless. It really has very few options because it never expected it would be this kind of breach that would face them. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, and I think he's right, because let's face it, the EU pinned itself into a corner, into its own little box. And let's not also forget, you have a lot of dynamics outside of Trump that are leading to a lot of chaos within the EU and NATO. You have Turkey, which is very iffy on its alliance with NATO and the West now. You have an EU which is very divided internally, from north to south and Eastern Europe to Western Europe. So you have a lot of dynamics which are causing a lot of chaos for the leaders in Brussels. And Trump is going to play on that. And I think also Russia will play on that.
Mark, that's a very interesting point, because there is very little unity right now within the European Union. And Russia has always complained that it doesn't know who to speak to in the European Union because they're not unified. Yeah. Well, we have it in spades now.
Yeah, I think the EU will wait Donald Trump out, be that 2 years, 4 years, 8 years. I think we've seen this before. But I'm far more worried about the internal stresses within the European Union, the election of a joint far-right, far-left government in Italy, noises of dissent in Hungary and Poland.
Mark,
and Austria.
Do you really think the Europeans can wait that long? It seems to me that the midterm elections in November in the United States will send an indication of what the European, they may wait a few months, but I don't think they can wait years.
Well, okay? This EU blocking statute is interesting. It's a 1996 provision meant to be used to protect European companies from the U.S. blockade on Cuba. So what it's going to do is it's going to ban EU companies supposedly from obeying the rule, although it's impossible to judge or enforce. And bans European courts from recognizing decisions against companies because of these sanctions, and it will open up the European Investment Bank. But German officials have already admitted they can't protect European companies. This is an outdated measure. They don't know how to update it. The Russian Duma is actually dealing with a nearly identical provision to forbid Russian companies from recognizing sanctions against Russia, and they're not having much luck with it either. But these are the European companies that already announced that they're pulling out of Iran. Total, the French energy giant. Maersk Tankers, the Danish shipping giant. Alliance, the German insurance company. Danieli, the Italian steel manufacturer. And China and Russia are jumping to step in.
Thank you very much, because that's exactly what
China
I was going to say.
Are rushing to step in and swoop up
these
shares.
Let me go to Dima here before we go to the break. There are plenty of players that will fill the breach here. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is why sanctions are a blunt weapon.
Yes.
They will not achieve policy objectives. Go ahead, Dima.
Basically, it's a boomerang. Sanctions are a boomerang. But I agree with Mark that this 1996 measure is outdated, precisely because the EU achieved its aim. Everything is now digitalized. You cannot escape control. There is no more banking secret in the EU. The EU officials have recognized it about three months ago, that you cannot keep your information, your banking information secret. It's on the record in the United States and in the West globally.
I'm afraid that EU sanctions are going to make a masochist out of me. I love them. Sanction Russia some more. Sanction me some more, baby. Sanction the EU some more. Sanction South Korea. Tariffs against China.
Let me go to Alex before we go to the break here. But this is really gets down to it's lawfare. Now everyone is involved in lawfare. The Americans perfected it. Now everyone's going to play the same game. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see that, you know, practically speaking, if companies do business with Iran, they may get punished by the U.S. If they don't do business with Iran, they're going to get punished by the EU. Of course, we're not going to see a lot of that happen. But practically speaking, if you look at the blocking statute, that's pretty much what it says. So it's absolute chaos.
Okay, well, you know what, and Alex, I'm going to go to the break here, but, you know, everyone gets penalized, and then the Russians and the Chinese come in and fill the breach. They get paid, okay? Again, the law of unintended consequences. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, Mark, I want to go back to a story that is unfinished, and I don't know if we'll ever be finished. The Skripals in the UK.
Who?
Yeah, exactly, because it's dropped off the pages here. Yeah. I mean, this is a story that will never end. Do you think we'll ever hear from the two principals again?
I don't know. And one of the reasons is that, according to members, prominent members of the British press, they have been issued orders from the government not to report on certain details of the Skripals affair. What exactly those details are, where those details might lead.
But what do the British government, their default position would be, it is to defend national security interests. Is that a viable defense?
Well,
it appears to be that they're using it.
The argument that British national security is threatened if British media questions the British government's own narrative about what happened and looks into details of this case does seem a little far-fetched to me.
Okay. Well, it seems peculiar to me as well, because they're defending something that hasn't been explained.
In another country. Another country, they might call it blatant censorship.
Okay, Dima, how do you look at this here? Well, because it was the biggest story in the news, and now it's hardly there.
Yeah.
And there's been an enormous amount of damage done as a result.
Look, if we compare it to the Litvinenko case, which started exactly 12 years ago, the Litvinenko case was much better staged. At least there were photos of him in the hospital. There were even interviews with him, even though controlled by some people around Berezovsky, by Lord Bell, who was their PR manager. But now we don't have the photos of the Skripals in the hospital. They were both discharged from the hospital, allegedly after touching this terrible nerve agent which just kills all the human beings around itself in the radius of 1 mile. They are somehow miraculously alive, but they don't give press conferences, they don't answer questions, they don't meet the British press, that free British press, which somehow could not enter that hospital.
Dima, I mean, the score of Skripal, let's make sure, supposedly Novichok, the score is Novichok 0, humans 3.
Absolutely.
Right? Because even though supposedly there is no cure, according to Britain's own leading scientists.
Well, don't forget about those guinea pigs and cats.
Okay? Two guinea pigs and a cat.
Let me let Alex jump in here. Go ahead.
Yeah, and let's not forget that the most disturbing part of all of this is that you had a Russian citizen denied access to speak with the Russian embassy. So, I mean, you see a blatant disregard for international law, a blatant disregard for diplomacy and international diplomacy. You had Russian citizens who were in trouble in a foreign country, and the UK government denied the embassy access to Yulia Skripal. And now you're going to have two people essentially disappear. I mean, no one's going to know where they're going to be taken to, where they're going to go. They're just going to be vanished off the face of the earth.
That's what we don't know. We don't know whether Yulia Skripal wants to talk to her family,
and to be fair here, I think it is incumbent upon the British government to be a little bit more transparent about their decision-making process, because this is a huge story of public interest. There were implications of the alleged poisoning and the alleged perpetrator. There have been political facts created on the ground, and I think that's why we need to know more, and we need more transparency.
I mean, they also promised to give Yulia a new identity. So it's not just...
Does she want one? Do we know that?
We don't know. No one interviewed her. This is the problem, you know.
There has been a statement issued by the British police, supposedly on her behalf, obviously not using her own words and command of the English
without
language.
Without her signature, without anything. So imagine you, me as a Russian citizen, coming to the UK, and then someone very wise takes me, tells everyone, oh, this guy was poisoned by RT propaganda. He needs treatment. He needs a new identity. The Russian embassy can't talk to him. So that's, you know, there is a precedent for a similar thing happening.
Okay, gentlemen, let's change.
If the roles were reversed, the international community, the Western democracy would be outraged if the roles were
there reversed. There would be hashtags free Yulia Skripal.
Okay.
We want to see you, Yulia Skripal.
All right, gentlemen, let's change gears here. I mean, I wanted to do this story earlier, but it's still going on here. The massacres are going on in Gaza. We had a UN resolution at the Security Council that was vetoed by the United States to look into an investigation and what happened there. One of the reasons why I'm bringing up the story is because I think that, again, Western media shamelessly did not cover the story with it, the accuracy and maybe morality that it was needed, basically saying it was a conflict of equal measure. Okay, no, one side had snipers and another side had no guns, had banners and flags. We have
and
a massacre
stones,
here, and
more.
there's this moral equivalence. Yeah. There is no immoral equivalence there, Mark.
Yeah, the Western media, and this is how propaganda is done, almost universally, discussed this massacre, and then it was a massacre. When you have 60-some people killed on one side and 2,400 possibly, I've seen that number, of injured on one side, and zero dead, zero injured on the other, that is not clashes. That is a massacre. And we continually had the use of the passive sense. Palestinians died. People died in clashes. No, they were killed. The Israeli regime, the Zionist regime in control of Israel and much of Palestine, killed 60 people and open fire, killing medics, women, children.
You know, Mark, I have a sense that on English language international television, you're one of the few people, individuals that have ever said anything of that magnitude about this massacre. This proves my point, okay? Because they still have Stormy Daniels, and we have Trump calling drug gangs from El Salvador animals. That gets the headlines, not a massacre of innocent people.
I mean, I can give you already several examples when the death of dozens of people, illegal death of dozens of people, did not matter to the to the Western press.
Donbass.
33 Odessa. Policemen killed in Kiev during the so-called peaceful protests against Yanukovych. 32 policemen killed. No, not a single word about them, you know, in the British or in the American press after President Yanukovych was ousted. They said that he fled in the middle of the night after having 32 policemen killed. Yes, he fled. Right? I would flee also, sorry. Then 60 Syrian soldiers killed by American aviation by mistake near Deir ez-Zor. And there was an apology. Yes, a year ago. An apology, which, you know, however, was kind of continued by American interference in Syria. Then now we have 60-something Palestinians killed. And again, this is not so important as, you know, the opening of the new embassy in Jerusalem, which was happening at that very moment, or maybe the marriage, the royal marriage in the UK. These are more important events than the illegal death of 60 people.
You know, Alex, I'm glad that Dima brought that up. I mean, we have basically in real time, we have the opening of the American embassy in Jerusalem against international law and UN resolutions. And we, you have basically a split screen, okay? Clashes, that are not clashes, it's a massacre. And then we have this opening of the American embassy with all smiles and all of that here. What kind of message is that send? Because it seems to me the Western media is sending a message of impunity. You can break international law and not be called on it, because if we look at the legal writing at the United Nations under Security Council resolutions, we're not making it up here. These are facts, okay? And then whitewashing a massacre in Gaza. What does that say about Western media and maybe Western policy in general?
Impunity and hypocrisy. Dima mentioned it, and I'll go even further. You know, when you had staged chemical attacks in Syria, the United States was about to go to war. And here you had 60 people killed via sniper fire. I mean, let that sink in. This is not, indiscriminate rifle fire just being sprayed everywhere. These are soldiers who are sitting, you know, in a position, and they're picking off people, and they're picking off not journalists, and they're picking off kids,
doctors,
picking off women,
not
doctors.
Just medics on the ground have reported, not only are they snipers, they were using butterfly bullets that are designed to fragment inside the body to do as much internal damage as possible.
This is not a wartime environment. This is civilians are being targeted here, not military.
And two-thirds of the people.
Peter,
go ahead. Alex, jump in Cyprus.
Real quickly, if I could just say the media quickly blamed it all on Hamas, saying, oh, well, why did Hamas bring children into this protest? Why did they push children towards the Israeli borders? I mean, it's absolutely sickening to think about it, that they're pinning the blame on all of this on Hamas bringing children into the line of fire.
Mark. If you vote for a political party, if you're a member of a political party that the Western governments, I don't like Hamas myself, right, any more than I like the Zionist regime in control of Israel. But if you belong to a political party that was elected democratically that they don't like, they have the right to massacre you. Did you know that?
That's the twisted logic here.
Also, let's not forget that Hamas is just the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, which the United States supported in Egypt, in Syria, in a lot of other places. The United States almost legitimized the Muslim Brotherhood. So
So did Israel by trying to break up Fatah.
Absolutely.
They wanted to have an alternative to it, and this is what they got. So again, Israel, every single foreign policy initiative they've taken almost since their existence backfires on them, okay? Hamas is the latest one. Oh, we could
Absolutely.
Talk about Hezbollah as well. It wasn't there before the invasion, illegal invasion of Lebanon. So, again, the law of unintended consequences.
And please look, when the Muslim Brotherhood went against the Syrian government of Mr. Assad in 2011, they were legitimized by the Western press. They were the just democracy fighters. When they went against the government of Israel, then you can kill 60 people and they won't even blink, So it's hypocrisy. It's hypocrisy at its peak, I would say.
But the interesting thing is we're going to have to end on this note here, and I'm going to take tear a page from Alex Christofori we have in Cyprus here. You can disagree with all the things that Donald Trump is doing, but he's keeping his word to his base and his campaign. I've never seen a president in my lifetime keep his word on things that I'm very much against.
Something.
At least he's consistent. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow and in Cyprus. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules. Okay, now for the extended version of our program, where we have political potpourri. Dima, you're up to bat first.
Well, the Huffington Post raised panic, this week. They published the so-called government contract of the two winning Italian parties, the Five Star Movement and the League.
Which is
a leftist party, and the League is a conservative rightist party. They're called populists and all kinds of bad names in Europe, but if you look at their programs, they are saying pretty sensible things, So what that government contract said was that they're going to push for lifting the sanctions on Russia. I don't see anything populist or stupid about it. They're pushing for asking the European Union to write off the debt, at least for 250 billion euros. Let me remind you that Italy actually owes 2 trillion euros to the EU. And they're pushing for putting more people in jail for thefts and for other crimes, which are no longer considered crimes in the new liberal society.
I looked at the election results, and I found it really quite fascinating, is that I don't see it as a hard, moving hard to the right, hard to the left. What I see is an abandonment of the liberal, neoliberal center. This is what people are walking away from. Hello, Brussels. This is continuing here. Okay, you want to follow up on that?
I just want to follow up. These two parties, the Five Star and League, they got the votes of more than 50% of Italian voters. Five Star, 37%. The League, about 17%. Then Silvio Berlusconi, demonized by all of the EU press has got about 17% with his Forward Italy movement. So basically, the Italian electorate has rejected the European mainstream.
Exactly.
And what happens is that immediately after the publication of that contract, the American ambassador summoned the political leaders of Italy to his residence in Rome.
To be disciplined.
And started saying that actually you don't suffer from sanctions on Russia. Your trade with Russia is growing. Well, thanks for not saying that it's thanks to Trump that it is growing.
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned that. And I just want to throw this out here before we go to Mark here, is that Brexit isn't an anomaly. Trump isn't an anomaly.
Yes.
Hungary isn't an anomaly. Political forces in Greece, not an anomaly. Mm-hmm. What's happening in Poland, not an anomaly. The status quo people better wake up.
It's blowback.
Okay? It's blowback. Go
it's
ahead,
It's blowback to liberal policies. And it said, this far left and the far right, they're looking for a new center because the EU neoliberal technocratic center that turned the EU into a nation state and national identity deconstruction machine was done over the heads of the European people.
Not one European voted for the project because there was never a vote for that project here. Mm-hmm. Mark, you want to, your topic?
Yeah, just briefly back on the whole affair with the Palestinians, Israel, and Hamas. Now, let me reiterate again, I am no particular big fan of Hamas. I dislike their Islamist politics, as Dima said, close to the Muslim Brotherhood. I very much wait till they turned on Syria, the one government in the world that was actually doing something to help the Palestinian people, the only Arab government for sure. But I don't dislike them any more than I dislike the authoritarian apartheid government that is ruling over Israel and much of Palestine and part of Syria and Golan Heights. South Africa was the moral voice of the world in the last week. They know apartheid, and they withdrew their ambassador from both Israel and the heart of the problem, the United States. In the United States, the best reporting on this was done by the satirical website The Onion
who talked about
Netanyahu mourning the damage done to the wall.
I think it was The Onion is that Netanyahu is talking about returning to Israel's ancient lands called Iraq and Iran.
And the New York Daily News, a tabloid, which called for which had a headline with Daddy's Little Ghoul showing Ivanka Trump smiling as these 60 people were killed as she was opening the new U.S. embassy, rebranded embassy. But in Gaza, two-thirds of the people in Gaza are refugees. Right. They are people who have been driven out of Palestine, out of their own lands, through a slow, methodical, unquestionable policy of ethnic cleansing via settlement and colonization.
And half the population are children.
And is it any wonder? We talk about doing radical things to spur terrorism in Syria, elsewhere. Where that's really happening is in Israel. They are in Palestine. The Israeli government is repeatedly ethnic cleansing and pushing people to any type of resistance.
Right, so they can mow the grass again. Alex, let's go back to Cyprus. You're our Russia Sherper, so give us an update. The mole has been identified. Go ahead.
The mole, the informant. Okay, Laura Ingraham last week pretty much outed the person who has been the talk of Washington, D.C. as the mole who was inside the Trump campaign feeding information to the FBI. In between Laura Ingraham's outing of this person, Zero Hedge, Red State, and other
Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal even pointed
Wall Street Journal also identified the person with near certainty as being Stefan Halper. And he's an American citizen, but also a professor in the UK. And he was, from what it seems, the whole Russia, the whole Russiagate narrative seems to be a setup from the beginning. And here you had, according to the New York Times, this is the New York Times reporting on this. Of course, they piggybacked off of the Daily Caller, which did an excellent job of pretty much breaking the whole story down. But the New York Times explains that Halper contacted Papadopoulos, who was the 28-year-old foreign advisor to Trump, and Papadopoulos, being Greek, was an expert in Mediterranean gas disputes between
Greece,
yes, Greece, Cyprus, and Turkey. And so you had Halper contact Papadopoulos and say, you know, and I'm going to quote the New York Times article, the informant offered a $3,000 honorarium to Papadopoulos for the paper and paid a trip to London where the two could meet and discuss the research. So Halper baited Papadopoulos to get to London, where in London, Papadopoulos met with Alexander Downing, the now infamous Australian diplomat, who fed information about Papadopoulos talking about the Russians hacking into Hillary's email to the FBI, which later kicked off much of the Russia collusion narrative. So here you have a complete, what appears to be a complete setup. Yeah. Of Trump campaign.
Yeah, well, what it is, overall, gentlemen, it is the fruit from the poison tree.
Absolutely.
Okay? It was a scam from the very, very beginning. And it was all done pre-planned, looking for entrapment, and that's what they've got. The interesting thing here, Dima, is that I'm not surprised this type of thing happens. What is surprising and what is really scary is that this is the state doing it against your political opponents.
Absolutely.
And this is infinitely bigger than Watergate, okay? Well, but will we see the corporate liberal media react? I doubt it, okay? It'll be on the margins.
Actually, if we're realistic, we can see that two persons can get punished for all of this. Michael Flynn, for talking to the Russian ambassador. I think he will be the first citizen of any country being punished for talking to a foreign ambassador after the wife of Molotov, who was punished by Stalin for talking to Israel's ambassador in 1953.
Golda Meir, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the second person is Paul Manafort, who had nothing to do with the American or the Russian election, who actually did some fraud during the Ukrainian elections. Tell me about the United States not interfering in Ukrainian elections, you know. So these are the two persons who can actually be punished. I don't know which case is worse.
Alex, because of your topic, I'll let you finish it off. There is strong evidence that Flynn didn't even lie. Okay? He didn't even lie.
To the vice president, yes.
Okay? And that was the takeaway from the FBI.
No, I mean, they leaned on Flynn hard. And they leaned on him, and they pretty much destroyed his life. I mean, they destroyed his reputation. They destroyed his life. And really, whatever Flynn did had nothing to do with Russia or Trump. It had to do with consulting with Turkey. So there was no collusion or no connection to Trump from the get-go. But what you do have is you have a setup from the get-go.
Okay, and collusion is not a crime. Mark is going to finish off the program here. How much longer are we going to listen to Russia, Russia, Russia?
A lot longer. Facebook has now partnered with the NATO's unofficial think tank,
Atlantic Council's
Forensics Laboratory Research, they will act as the guardians of truth or a truth ministry over Facebook.
The PR
Zuckerberg
arm of NATO.
These are the ones who just recently falsely identified citizens, an Australian citizen, Syrian girl partisan, and Ian Schelling.
They are
in the
real
UK
people. They
as
are real people.
Bots or Kremlin trolls, and they'll be the ones. Telling you what's true and what's not on Facebook.
No,
the Atlantic Council.
We're going to finish on this point. That's why people need to watch this program, because you will get the truth here. Okay, gentlemen? All right. We'll see you next week. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.